Thanks. Again, for those of you who have just joined us, welcome to today's Research to Practice webinar hosted by the SPRC Training Institute. At this moment, nearly 300 people are connected to this webinar from 44 U.S. states. Welcome to every one of you. Now to our presentation. Tiff, next slide. Thank you. Today we are fortunate to have David Nesper, John Draper, and Rick Oliver with us. First, we'll hear from Dr. Nesper, who is a nationally recognized leader in suicidology and suicide prevention education. Dr. Nesper is Associate Professor, Active Emeritus, Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan Medical School, and from 2003 to 2011 was Director of the Hospital Psychiatry Section at the University of Michigan Hospital. He was responsible in that role for psychiatric emergency services, adult inpatient psychiatry, and psychiatry consultation services for hospitalized patients with general medical problems. He's the author of Continuity of Care for Suicide Prevention and Research, a publication funded by the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and published in 2011 by SPRC in collaboration with the American Association of Suicidology and the University of Michigan. Dr. Nesper served on the board of directors of the American Association of Suicidology from 2008 to 2011, and he continues as an active consultant to the board. Tiffany, if you could please unmute Dr. Nesper's line, we'll get started with the presentations. Thanks. Okay, Dr. Nesper, please go ahead. David?
I need to advance the slides.
Yes.
And I'm not doing that.
Okay. Tiffany?
I'm sorry. There we are.
Good job.
Good job. The title for today's discussion, now that the technical issues are resolved, it is identical to the title of the report that I authored. And you've already heard about the report. It is available simply by entering the name of the report in most search engines. And, of course, you can download it from the SPRC online library at the address listed on this slide. Today, I plan to translate many of the 20 clinical recommendations found in this report into practical action steps that may be transportable to crisis centers, emergency departments, and health systems in general. Many of these practical implementations are part of best practices at the University of Michigan Health System. Hereafter, I'm going to refer to our system as simply Michigan. One overview of continuity of care for suicide prevention and research may be represented by the two themes on this slide. The first theme asserts that suicide rates may be reduced if integrated networks of care provide to community populations prompt follow-up care and evidence-based treatments. Now, follow-up care is so important that the report makes the recommendation that continuity of care principles be a major component of any transformed system of health and mental health care in America. What are the consequences of what I will call a discontinuity, particularly during the first month subsequent to discharge from an emergency department or an inpatient unit? Now, discontinuity references what I will call usual practice, which often is simply giving the patient a referral. This slide makes the point that the first month after discharge may be deadly. During the first month of usual care, Randomized control trials have a usual care arm. And in the trials that are represented on this slide, the usual care is associated during that first month with a 10% suicide reattempt rate and a 1% suicide death rate. One of the authors concluded, "The results of our study indicate that there is a need to offer help and support very soon after the suicide attempt." Now, you would think that because that first month is so crucial for follow-up care, that there would be mechanisms to get people to follow-up care. Unfortunately, 50% of patients fail to arrive at the first follow-up visit, and as many as 70% either fail to arrive or drop out of treatment in one or two visits. Now, is there any scientific evidence that follow-up prevents suicide? Well, there are only two randomized controlled trials, which is the most effective scientific method for identifying what works. There are only two randomized controlled trials in the whole world literature that have identified interventions that prevent suicide, and the interventions are quite similar. There is an initial contact with a clinician. This is usually an educational contact, education about suicide, suicide behavior, and this is followed by a series of brief, in these two studies, relatively low effort follow-up contacts. The study summarized at the top of the slide simply used a series of sustained short letters that were mailed to the participants in the trial. The second study involved a series of up to nine brief, and what do I mean by brief? I mean 5 minutes was the average, follow-up contacts thereafter. Many of these contacts were made by telephone. The authors of both of these studies emphasized the need for follow-up and what I will call connectedness. Somebody cares. I'm next going to talk about what are practical action steps, practical responses that crisis centers and other providers of mental health services can use to implement some of the recommendations that are made in the report. The Continuity of Care Report has a section describing the relative inattention given to suicide risk assessment and management in most training programs. On this slide are some of the initiatives at Michigan to improve education and training in suicide prevention. We have a mandatory training course which is available on video, and this course emphasizes suicide risk assessment and management. The course is based on the suicide assessment five-step evaluation and triage model, so-called SAFETY, SAFE-T, which is available from the SPRC. Now, Michigan's morbidity and mortality conferences and related investigations of suicide deaths have identified several key suicide prevention strategies for use with individual patients. I'll go through these quickly. First, we have found that the verbal denial of risk is of relatively low value. For this reason, we emphasize the use of risk and protective factors to guide clinical decision making. Often, patients who are at most risk for suicide distort their true risk. For this reason, collaborative information is required and, if necessary, without the patient's consent. This is consistent with the guideline of the American Psychiatric Association and, in our state, with the state of Michigan's Mental Health Code. Contracting for safety has been found to be ineffective, and for this reason we emphasize safety planning and all of the features associated with safety planning, the most important of which is firearms inquiry. Because firearms is the most common way for people to die. A contact with a client or patient may begin with some sort of screening. Unfortunately, most screening tools are proprietary and not widely available unless you pay for them. That doesn't mean that you can't create your own tool. And here is a practical screening tool, a 5-point scale, that can be used during an interview with a patient. It goes from want to die at 1 and definitely want to live at 5. Where does the patient place? This simple scale was developed on a contract with Samson, presented about 3 years ago at the American Association of Suicidology's annual conference. We do use a scale, which is the Columbia Suicide Severity Rating Scale. This scale allows us to categorize the various suicide-related behaviors and also rates their severity. It may also be used as a screening tool, and it is available from the people at Columbia on the website listed below. Now, the emergency department visit contains many component parts, and this slide lists 4 of the most important. I already mentioned that the 2 trials that found an intervention that prevents suicide use education. Here, there is emphasized education about risk factors. This might be the same thing as a clinician might give a patient for prevention of a heart attack or a similar catastrophic event. Why is the person at risk? Is there a history of suicide in the family? Does the patient have suicidal ideation? Does the patient have depression? You know most of the risk factors, as do I. If a patient is to get to the referral appointment, there is some form of adherence counseling and motivational interviewing that would serve the patient well. This would involve discussion of what might be the obstacles the patient might find to follow-up care. Do we give phone contact and reminders to patients? My dentist and all of my health care providers do this. Why don't we do it in mental health? Does the patient arrive at the follow-up appointment? Is there a system for arrival confirmation? Now, if we do much of this and we institute safety planning procedures, we often can, along with our suicide risk assessment, make a decision to admit or to discharge. Now, safety planning involves the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. In our system, we give the 1-800-273-TALK along with some instructions. John Draper from the Suicide Prevention Lifeline will expand on the utilities available from the Lifeline. I feel very strongly that we should have suicide prevention in the form of a brief anti-suicide intervention that can be used in the emergency department or in a crisis program. After all, one visit may be the only opportunity we get to speak with a patient. There are no brief anti-suicide interventions that have been clearly identified. What we talked about before may certainly be part of the foundation. I'm pleased to report that there is a national study, the Emergency Department Safety Assessment and Follow-Up Evaluation, ED-SAFE. This is a $12 million project over 8 centers across the country to develop standardized screening tools for use in the emergency department for patients at risk, and to refine and test an ED-initiated intervention to prevent suicide. Now, while I want to have every patient the target for suicide prevention strategies, this, for many systems, including our own, may not be practical. For this reason, high-risk patients need to be targeted by policy. Now, the Joint Commission, which oversees all hospitalized mental health care and outpatient care as well in academic and local institutions, most frequently identifies deficiencies that are associated with suicide, and this is the problem with handoff. For this reason, we have special training for mandatory handoffs that provide explicit information to clinicians, and particularly information about continuity of care instructions. What are the next steps that need to be done now that you are taking over care? We've instituted a policy for our emergency department and our inpatient unit that has an appointment within 7 days of discharge. Now, this is easier said than done, even in the system that we control. For this reason, we often have patients return to the emergency department for a bridging appointment. When no appointment is possible within 7 days, we have a transition clinic. An appointment is always available in our transition clinic during the first 7 days of discharge. Once a patient does get to the follow-up appointment, there needs to be follow-up for missed appointments. After all, this patient is at risk for suicide, and why is the patient not coming to a scheduled appointment? We very much believe in a staffing model that includes more full-time than part-time staff. After all, fewer clinicians are available for training and implementation of suicide prevention strategies. Now, crisis centers can help achieve the goal of 7 days or less. Partnerships between crisis centers and emergency departments might increase the likelihood of making an appointment. Later in this webinar, Rick Oliver will describe one model for this sort of partnership model. Again, if we target high-risk outpatients, this time the focus is on outpatients, we have the situation where clinicians leave. They might leave for an extended sick time, or they simply may go to another institution. Of the patients that they care for, which are the high-risk patients? And again, there's an emphasis on mandatory handoffs for these high-risk patients, continuity of care instructions, and scheduling the next appointment. After all, increase in suicide behaviors follows a decrease in the intensity of care. This has been found again and again by scientific studies. Again, routine follow-up for missed appointments. And in an outpatient program, immediate consultation is a component of care. Clinicians should simply not be alone. All of our outpatient programs are contained in one building. And in that building, there is the doctor, there is the clinician of the day who is available for help in any sort of situation. And most of the time, that situation is a patient at risk for suicide. Every facility needs a way of holding patients for transportation to the emergency department from an outpatient clinic, and patients should have a suicide plan for securing the patient. Rather, a suicide prevention plan for securing the patient. Now, I want to turn to inpatients. And crisis centers are crucial to effective inpatient care. As a partner, crisis centers can help the inpatient system to adopt best practices that improve care. What might be some of these best practices that involve continuity of care? Here, a representative, for example, a representative from the crisis center, may come to the inpatient unit and represent the outpatient appointment to facilitate that appointment for the patient. We use a system of automatic faxing on the day of discharge of records. Therefore, there is continuity of information. Many inpatient programs don't have explicit programming for at-risk patients. Here is outlined some of the things that we do in our inpatient programming. The Hope Box was developed by Greg Brown and Carol Stanley, and this involves building essentially a container for reminders of what is important that keeps the patient alive. Again, this slide emphasizes a hospitalist model. Now, I emphasized connectedness and follow-up contacts. This was the intervention used by both studies that found an intervention that prevents suicide. We've developed a system here called the Michigan Depression Outreach and Collaborative Care System, and this is a managed care program. It assigns a case manager to patients. Patients are monitored for response to treatment using rating scales and regularly scheduled appointments. The care manager is a direct contact for the patient and is a person that reminds of all appointments. A more innovative model is the 24/7 mobile mood monitoring. Every person has a cell phone. In many states, cell phones are available free to people who cannot otherwise afford them. The cell phone can be used from a central station to remind patients to complete on the cell phone a user-friendly rating scale, in this case, a rating scale for mood. The 24/7 project has in development an alert system for suicidality. That is, the patient can say, "I'm in trouble, please contact me," and this can all be done by phone. Now, one goal that I stated at the beginning was an integrated system of care. And one way to achieve an integrated system of care in the absence of any national leadership is to form a local coalition, a mental health work group composed of all partners providing crisis and mental health services. Some of the items on the agenda might be obstacles to working together. How to share patient information, particularly with rules of confidentiality. What happens if I have a patient that needs special attention and I want to communicate that information to you? What about including some of the providers that are not in our work group? For instance, providers who are in private practice. Can we develop a website that links organizations so that there is one place for a patient to go to find out where to get mental health services in our local area? I feel very strongly that all suicide attempts and certainly suicide deaths should be investigated. And this means there needs to be a mandatory reporting system, either at the level of the individual organization or at the level of a coalition. This is the only way we have to develop an action plan for improvements in the healthcare system. This is not an attempt to identify a clinician who is not doing his or her job. This is an attempt to find mechanisms that can identify improvements for the entire healthcare system and thereby improve follow-up care as well as the other aspects of care. And with this, I end my presentation, and I certainly am available for questions.
Thank you, David, very much. At this point, we have just one question that we can handle offline. It's a recommendation for articles on the difference between safety planning and contract, and we can make some information available later in the webinar related to that. But seeing no questions about your content, I think we'll move on, and there'll be an opportunity for folks to ask questions of Dr. Nesper later on at the end of the webinar as well. And just as a reminder, please do type any questions you'd like to ask into the question pane on your screen. Now, I'm very pleased to introduce Dr. John Draper, who has nearly 23 years of experience in crisis intervention and suicide prevention work and is considered one of the nation's leading experts in crisis hotline practices. Since 2004, Dr. Draper has been the director of the SAMHSA-funded National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, 800-273-TALK, overseeing all aspects of this service. He is also Mental Health America, New York City's Vice President of Crisis and Behavioral Health Technologies, and the founding director for MHA NYC's award-winning LifeNet Call Center from 1996 to 2004, a center which is now one of 152 members in the Lifeline's national network. Dr. Draper is also the primary Lifeline liaison to both SAMHSA and the VA Crisis Line, and plays a key role in coordinating communications and service needs of of these federal agencies with Lifeline staff, its network of crisis centers, and three national committees of suicide prevention experts that advise the Lifeline on best practice approaches. Prior to his crisis center work, Dr. Draper spent over 7 years as a psychologist and clinical director of a Brooklyn mobile crisis team. Tiffany, if you could unmute John's line, please. I'll just wait a moment. John, are you on?
I'm here. Thank you, Lori.
Excellent.
Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Well, thanks for introducing me, and thank you, David, for another very informative presentation. David spoke of how critical continuity of care is in suicide prevention, particularly in relation to discharge from emergency departments and hospitals. And today, I'm going to speak about an innovative model that involves crisis centers, something that David also alluded to, and how they can work with emergency departments post-discharge in a model that, in fact, that can also be applied to hospital discharges as well. But the first thing I think for us to be clear about is what crisis centers are, what we're talking about when we're talking, using that phrase, and interchangeably with hotlines. And the reason we do that often is because the very first suicide hotline started with the very first crisis center. That was the Los Angeles Suicide Prevention Center here in the United States in 1958, which was founded by Ed Schneidman, the father of suicidology, and his colleagues Norm Farborough and Bob Littman. And what they actually started was something that was funded through a National Institute of Mental Health grant back in 1958, really to study suicide, what they called suicidology. And that meant they were going to be collecting data about suicides and promoting treatment that they thought would prevent suicides, and to train the community to identify persons who could be at suicide risk, collaborate with agencies to promote a chain of care that could reduce suicide, as well as reducing stigma about talking about suicide through education. This probably sounds a lot like what many of our crisis centers are doing today. That model hasn't changed. In fact, one of the things that they discovered early when they established this first crisis center was that people were starting to phone in at all hours saying they were in suicidal crisis. And Ed Schneidman and his colleagues began to scratch their head and said, you know, we should start a hotline. And they then integrated a hotline into the Suicide Prevention Center that year, where they used volunteers with protocols for training, listening, assessment, counseling, and referral. And this hotline was not 24/7 at first, but became 24/7 in 1962 after Marilyn Monroe killed herself, and many people began to phone this hotline more than at off hours. So they said, we've got to expand to 24/7. Hotlines today, though, while they have not changed considerably, they vary widely, and they're all over the place. They're in 61 countries. We're talking about 1,200 crisis centers, 600 here in the United States. And they vary in terms of their size, their funding, and the staffing. The one thing that they really all have in common, at least theoretically, is non-judgmental listening and confidentiality. And they do seek to assess callers for suicidality and other risks, as well as refer people to care. And it's important to understand that these crisis centers or suicide prevention hotlines are really community hubs for suicide prevention. They are agencies that are devoted to often engaging the community in many ways through volunteers and also by providing community-wide access. They want to make sure that they're providing a service that is accessible to everyone in the community, where there is no stigma, no barriers for care. That is, if they have a phone, they can get care whenever they need it. It's also important to see it as a place where a community of providers are attached and engaged through their referral mechanisms, that they basically are a meta service whose service it is to link to other services. Now, crisis centers, you'll learn, also provide some brief counseling over the phone, but often they seek to link to other services in the community. They also provide public education, typically training in mental health anti-stigma promotion. So in many ways, these crisis centers are kind of the ultimate community mental health center. Now, what do they have in common with emergency departments? There was recently, this year, in fact, a survey of the American College of Emergency Physicians where they asked this question: which of the following best describes the main role your emergency department plays in the lives of your community? And the ED docs gave these top three responses, which is, well, we provide acute care, we link to the entire healthcare system, and we're 24-hour medical care provider, and we're available when all the other providers are closed. Well, that's very similar to what crisis centers also provide for the behavioral health care system in their communities: the 24/7 availability, the system entry points for persons in acute crisis. They provide assessment, immediate intervention, and they're typically not set up for ongoing care and treatment. It's mostly linkages and referrals, but they do provide often brief counseling over the phone. So that really the two questions that I want to focus on today in this presentation are: crisis hotlines effective in reducing distress and suicidality? And if they are there ways in which emergency departments and crisis centers can work together to more effectively and cost efficiently reduce suicide? And I'm going to talk about this through the lens of the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline Network, and hopefully this will become apparent to you as to why, starting with a mission, which is to effectively reach and serve all persons who could be at risk of suicide in the U.S. through a national network of crisis call centers. This project is funded by SAMHSA, and we receive the funds here at Link to Health Solutions. We're a wholly owned subsidiary of the Mental Health Association of New York City, and we've been operating this grant since 2004. Along with our partners, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, I'll refer to them later as NASHPID, and also our parents, MHA NYC, as well as Columbia and Rutgers Universities, now mostly or exclusively Columbia, that have provided evaluation for the hotline services, which I'll get to shortly. LivingWorks has also provided for more than half of the centers in our network free suicide prevention trainings, in this case the ASSIST trainings. Free for them, but not for us. We pay them to provide those trainings. Now, about the network specifically, 152 centers are now in the network. That grows in order to increase our capacity with growing call volume. And all of the crisis centers in the network are independently operating. We don't fund them to be a part of the network. They are part of the network voluntarily. And most of the crisis centers are a mix of volunteers and professional staff. They're all certified by national accrediting bodies, and all of the centers in the Lifeline Network adopt best practice standards. So though there's 152 centers, probably about one out of every four centers in the nation are part of the Lifeline Network. What I'll talk about may apply to many of the crisis centers that are also not in the network, but I can only vouch for the ones that are. And to give you a sense of how busy we are, last year, about 700,000 calls, 20% of which went to the VA crisis line, which is accessible by pressing 1 when you phone the 800-273-TALK number. That's through a partnership between the VA and SAMHSA and the Lifeline. And this year, we probably are going to get closer to about 780,000 calls. Now, I wanted to say this, which I think is very important about the Lifeline and why it relates to the topic at hand, is we're looking for things that work. And it's good to know that SAMHSA is funding a national network with the knowledge that we've got to evaluate it to make sure it's working, and to the extent it's not, how can we improve it? And from the outset, when they began funding the Lifeline, they instituted an evaluation process which would evaluate the work of our crisis centers, feed that information back to the Lifeline, and in turn, we would then come up with best practices standards through our national advisory committees, and then implement those across the network, which in turn would again be evaluated by, in this case, Columbia. This is the New York State Psychiatric Institute, Columbia Presbyterian team, led primarily by Maddie Gould. At one time, Maddie and John Califat from Rutgers were involved, and some of their initial findings taught us something that was very important about what happens when you call the line. Now, there's certainly some areas of improvement, and that's a whole nother presentation. But for the purposes of this, I want to make an argument that I think will be important in terms of determining how crisis centers can be helpful in continuity of care. First, it's important to note here that we're actually reaching suicidal callers. Many people thought that, well, if you're really suicidal, why would you pick up the phone and call a line? And Califat, Gould, and Munfuck in 2007 published research, or in this case, the evaluation findings from this SAMHSA-funded evaluation, noting that more than 50% of the suicidal callers had a plan. Over 8% were actually in the progress or in the process of actually killing themselves when they phoned. Nearly 60% of the suicidal callers had past suicide attempts, and they did say this was an underestimate, that really many of the callers were too high risk to be included in the evaluation. They just needed a rescue at the time. But overall, about one out of every four callers, the Lifeline, has thoughts, plans related to suicide or past attempts. But importantly, what Gould and Califat found, that these calls actually reduced confusion, anger, anxiety, helplessness, hopelessness, not only at the end of the call, but 3 weeks later upon follow-up, when they followed up with these callers to see how they were doing. They also noted significant reductions in suicidality at the end of the call and when they followed up with them 3 weeks later. And importantly, 12% of the suicidal callers reported just spontaneously when asked, in what ways was this call helpful for you? They said, well, it kept me from killing myself. And that was really the first evidence that we had that this is an effective means of preventing suicide for those callers. Now, why is this important? It's important certainly in relation to our collaboration with EDs, to the extent that when we think about how we might actually divert people from emergency department visits, that if they can call a line and actually get help on the line 24/7, they may not have to go and sit and wait for a while in emergency departments that are already overcrowded. They can also, hotlines can also follow up with high-risk callers to their line in the event that they're not, rather than sending them to the emergency department. I'll talk about that shortly. And they can also follow up with discharged patients to support their aftercare. We'll also talk about that model shortly. But in terms of the diversion needs, it's instructive for us to remember that our emergency departments, for many people, have now become the ad hoc mental health care system. About 75% increase in mental health emergency department visits was seen in approximately a 12-year span of time from 1992 to 2004. And we also saw not only an increase in mental health visits, but more suicide attempts were seen in emergency departments. And actually, while more were seen, fewer admissions for the attempts were occurring. So where were they going? Well, they hopefully were going to outpatient resources, but we heard from David earlier that a lot of them aren't showing up. And in addition, a lot of the emergency department directors are saying, well, there's just not enough community referrals out there. 76% noted that, in research that was reported by Larry Braff back in 2006. Recently, that survey from ASEP stated that 97% of the emergency department doctors said overcrowding was happening because they just couldn't find any outpatient help where and when they needed it, noting that in many cases, providers were either not around or just simply closed. So how does that speak to reducing burden, perhaps through the use of crisis centers? The Joint Commission in 2007 noted in their hospital patient safety goals on suicide that they really should be providing information, such as crisis hotline information, to individuals and their family members for crisis situations who are being discharged from the hospital emergency departments, so they'll know that there are other options when they're in crisis. We have a couple of examples from our two Lifeline centers. Behavioral Health Response in Missouri noted that they were able to reduce emergency department visits at a local state psych hospital by 7% in 1 year by linking more people with mobile outreach services. The Georgia Crisis and Access Line, which is now a single entry point for the behavioral health system in Georgia, they provide triage, linkages to clinics, hospitals, and mobile outreach. They reported about a 50% decrease in outpatient appointment wait time through their scheduling of appointments through their single entry point system. And when they were just operating in one county alone, Fulton County, they saved about $16 million in less than 5 years in unnecessary state hospital admissions. And they reported this to the state, and actually as a result of that, that's how they became ultimately the single point of entry for the state. They really saw this as a huge cost savings. But let's also talk about the life-saving potential here, specifically in relation to continuity of care, as David was referring to earlier. There is a lot of potential in terms of telephone follow-up. It's not easy to follow up face-to-face. And many people, in fact, prefer to be contacted by phone. It is a lot easier than meeting somebody often. In fact, when a French study was conducted back in, and it was published in 2006 by Baeva and his colleagues, they had about 13 emergency departments in France that where 605 attempt survivors were involved. And what they did was they herded some into a telephone follow-up and the other into treatment as usual. And most of the patients said, I really prefer the telephone follow-up as opposed to going to the clinic if that could be arranged. And I thought that was an interesting finding. Again, how to meet people where they want to be met in terms of their care. And what they found through their follow-up, which is basically providing empathy, reassurance, explanation, suggestion, crisis intervention as needed, many of the things that crisis centers provide routinely, they showed a reduction in reattempts at 1 month. They said, you know, we could have even reduced attempts more if we had followed up within 1 or 2 weeks. Also noting this in the Fleischman study that David spoke about earlier, one of the two randomized controlled trials, we contacted Alexandra Fleischman and said, exactly how did they do the follow-up? And she said, well, it really was mostly through telephone. So that method is very important for us to remember because it's extremely convenient and something that crisis centers have been doing for 50 years. Now, recently, Maddie Gould and Allison Lake and her colleagues have been looking at follow-up from high-risk callers, the Lifeline. Six Lifeline centers received SAMHSA follow-up grants, and actually two of them followed up in addition to phone, also through texting, for those that opted for texting. And they wanted to see if this follow-up had an impact on suicidal callers and the effects of safety plan training on reducing their suicidality. And these were pretty suicidal folks. I mean, about 493 of them, 55% had previous attempts, 47% with a plan, and actually 11% of them were trying to kill themselves when they were calling. And here's what they found. When they asked this question, to what extent did the counselors calling you stop you from killing yourself? About 80% of the folks said it helped them, with over half saying, well, it really kept me from killing myself. What was interesting is they also found the same response with text messages. Now, why I think that's very important for us to note is that we're often thinking, well, you know, the only effective care is face-to-face. So now we make an argument that perhaps telephone can also reduce suicidality by enhancing easy connectedness, reaching people when and where they want to be met. But so can text messages. I mean, for a while with telephone, we were saying, well, you know, you can't do it with text because that's so limited. That's not going to help. But if that's the way people want to be connected, that, in fact, according to Maddie's research, works too. Here's some of the feedback they received from the callers. What stopped me from hurting myself was that someone who doesn't know me had interest in me, cared about me. I've lost so many people in my life in such a hard way, and I stopped caring about my life. I haven't had anyone support me that way, and them calling me gave me a boost. Another caller said the follow-up calls really gave me the message that they really did care and that it wasn't just a one-time resource if I needed to turn to them again. That was really what kept me from continuing with my suicidal thoughts. Another one said, without those calls, I would have gone the other way. She gave me something to work on, something to look forward to. A number of our centers are practicing follow-up. We have only surveyed at this at the time I noted this in the slide, about 57 of our centers and out of 152. And of those 57 that have returned the survey at that time, about 56% were doing routine follow-up, and about 18% were actually working with emergency departments. One such model you'll be hearing from shortly. Rick Oliver and the folks at Mental Health Services in Cleveland have been doing a terrific job. You'll be hearing about his model. Another model, the Sacramento Emergency Department Crisis Center follow-up model. The effort is from Sacramento, the Crisis Center, and the Sutter Medical Center reported these findings from their collaboration. Whereas 98 patients consented, they were able to contact 93. Four of the phones were out of service. One, the person was in jail. They were able to contact most of them within 24 hours. All of them had suicidal ideation, recent and or prior suicide attempts. And they were able over 90% of the patients contacted connected with discharge referrals. It was important also, as they noted, that 100% reported lower distress and 100% had followed up with their safety plan. Now, that didn't mean it was always working, that safety plan. As we note here, two reattempts and two readmissions, still lower than the 10% figure that David had reported. But I think, as I was talking with the folks from the effort, that said that one of those two reattempts in that year span was from a person who has made many attempts and had never engaged in treatment in a way that was really helpful afterwards. Now she is engaged in a level of care that is providing her with more support than ever and really making a difference in keeping her safe and giving her more hope. So we're hoping that we've, through this follow-up effort, have actually reduced or changed or switched that cycle from a vicious cycle to now a virtuous one. There was another Contra Costa Crisis Center in California did an inpatient discharge follow-up collaboration with a local hospital. And they noted that about 59 attempt survivors were followed up for a period of 8 months. All of them said it was at least somewhat helpful. And 98% said that calls made them feel more safe and connected. And no persons attempted suicide over 8 months. The NASHBID white paper that went out to the state mental health authorities back in March 2008 also noted that there are recommendations for crisis centers, and they said that really not only should they be helpful, are crisis centers helpful for rural areas where there are few resources, but they are a critical piece of the continuity of care for at-risk persons, and they should be used to support at-risk persons after emergency department and or hospital discharge. As we think about cost-cutting measures in healthcare reform, it's important, I think, also for us to remember that the Affordable Care Act is really wanting to reduce hospital readmissions, test sustainable funding streams for care transition services, maintain or improve the quality of care, all of the things basically that we're able to report with this model. It's worth looking at, and with crisis centers being available to do this sort of work, it's an opportunity for our state and tribal prevention directors, our crisis center directors, our emergency department and hospital administrators to begin thinking about how they can use these cost-cutting, life-saving approaches. Here's a few calls to action that I just wanted to note for the people who might be listening in on this webinar. that for the state and tribal suicide prevention directors and coordinators, they could engage the suicide prevention community locally and state hospital associations locally and say, let's make recommendations for how our local EDs could be engaging other partners, including crisis centers and outreach to enhance continuity of care. We should also be promoting partnership incentives and grant RFPs between EDs and crisis centers, even if not through the state or GLS grants, then through community foundations or United Way chapters. In all of these circumstances, you can be contacting Marshall Ellis, who works with us. He's our Director of Outreach and Partnership Development. You'll see his email address and phone number at the bottom. But for the Suicide Prevention Coalition member, you can certainly connect with your local Lifeline Crisis Center. You can find I'll show you the center locator shortly, and work with local and regional hospital associations to identify solutions for emergency departments, including partnerships with crisis centers. Emergency department administrators, you can certainly also look at the crisis center locator and contact your local crisis center. Discuss with them their partnership capacity and how the two of you can work together. This is the Lifeline resource locator where you can find the crisis center nearest you. You can also certainly contact your local Department of Mental Health, ask them what the crisis center is if you're not aware of one locally, and they, whether or not they're a Lifeline member, may be able to assist you. Crisis center directors, you know you can certainly contact us at any time, and we'll be able to give you guidance and direction along these lines to how you might be able to collaborate with your local emergency departments. These are the folks you can contact at Lifeline, but for now, I'm more than happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you, John. And we do have a couple of questions. First one is there any published research on the specifics of what should or should not be addressed in a follow-up call?
Not published research yet. In fact, Maddie is in the process of analyzing all of the research findings that she has. We just had a meeting this last week where I was asking her and our Standards Training and Practices Subcommittee, what are the elements of a crisis call in a follow-up setting that are most effective? So she's going to be plumbing through the research findings that she already has to see if she can help answer those questions, and we'll be also talking with all of our crisis centers and getting at least anecdotally, if not data-wise, what they're doing to help us answer that question as well.
Great. And then a question from a little bit towards the beginning of your presentation. What constituted an inappropriate discharge?
Yeah, that's something that some of the crisis centers reported, and it's not something that we defined. That some were, I guess, an inappropriate discharge from their standpoint was somebody who they believed was really suicidal that they had to follow up with. I don't know whether they heard about it from the emergency department or the hospital. But somebody informed them that somebody was suicidal, and that was probably their value judgment, not ours.
Here's a question. Is there any information on the effectiveness of providing peer support or having the follow-up crisis call provided by a peer support specialist?
Well, there's not any data specifically.
These are all good questions, huh?
Yeah, there's not any data specifically about that, about who is making the call. But there are a lot of reasons to believe that that could be very effective. It's actually something that we really do promote and want to encourage the use of peers and as much care as possible. I think it really reduces stigma and helps people feel less alone.
Great. Thanks, John. I think we'll go ahead and move on. For those of you who have asked questions, I'm going to save one or two of them till the end when all three of the presenters can possibly respond to them. And let me just look. I just got one more. I want to check it out before I... Okay. So I do want to emphasize before we move on that something John said, that and just emphasize that while Lifeline is a pioneer and a resource for this follow-up care model, if you don't have a Lifeline crisis center near you, what we're hoping is that hospitals will reach out to their local crisis centers, even if they are not part of a Lifeline network. And I will mention again that the slides will be available on the SPRC Training Institute website, both the audio and the slides themselves, after the presentations today. Now, I'm pleased to introduce Rick Oliver, Director of Crisis and Trauma Services at Mental Health Services, Inc. In this capacity, he directs approximately 60 full and part-time staff in 4 separate crisis response programs. He's held this position for the past 7 years. Prior to that time, Mr. Oliver was a program manager for the Adult Mobile Crisis Team, a position he held for 9 years. Mr. Oliver has a master's degree in education with a focus on community counseling and is a professional clinical counselor in the state of Ohio. With 25 years of experience in the field of community mental health treatment and more than 20 years of management experience, he's a graduate of the Mental Health Executive Leadership Program from Case Western Reserve's Weatherhead School of Management. Mr. Oliver is currently the chair of the Cuyahoga County Suicide Prevention Task Force in Ohio. Rick, are you ready to go ahead?
Yes, I am.
Excellent. Thank you.
And thank you for the introduction. My part of this presentation is really to discuss a pilot project that we did with emergency room follow-ups towards the end of 2010 and into the beginning of 2011, using the grant that was mentioned, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline grant that we had an opportunity to apply for, and use that when we saw an opportunity to reach out to people who needed some assistance. Just a second about our agency. We are one of the 152 Lifeline centers in the country. We are one of the small, on the small side, we take about 17,000-18,000 calls a year, and we also have we operate the suicide hotline for our county, and we have a mobile crisis outreach team that we also coordinate as well. The emergency room follow-up gave us an opportunity to reach out to people that a different way to reach out to people that we were really looking for. In 2010, for example, 112 people died in our county by suicide, but our crisis team and our suicide hotline only had a previous lifetime contact with 10 of those individuals, and none of them within the 60 days prior to their death. I like to think that that tells us that we do a pretty good job with the people we make contact with, but there are a lot of people who are dying by suicide in this county who don't either know about us or don't call us for help, and we were looking for a way to reach out to those individuals. So we jumped at this opportunity to reach out to people being discharged from emergency rooms. With the mobile crisis team, we already have a relationship with the 17 emergency rooms in our county. We frequently go there and do assessments for people who are in crisis and who likely need an admission. We do authorize admissions to the state hospital in our county. So we're very familiar with each of the emergency rooms and going out to see people at the emergency rooms. This was a way to reach out to people who we weren't seeing by for people who were being discharged from the emergency rooms who didn't need a hospitalization but still may have been somewhat at risk for suicide. We decided to choose one hospital to focus on, and we worked with Lutheran Hospital, and we developed a memorandum of understanding with that hospital. We then created a consent form for the patient to sign so that took care of the sharing of information component, and we came up with some very simple referral protocol. The person had to be from our county, and they had to sign the consent form. And we wanted the person to have some level of suicidal concern as they were being discharged, but of course not enough that would warrant a hospitalization. We created a one-page referral form, trying to make it as simple as possible. We know the emergency room staff don't have a lot of time to be dealing with extra paperwork, so we wanted to make this as simple as possible for the emergency room staff to provide us with the contact information we needed. And then we went to the emergency room and trained all 3 staff. This was a very short training. It took about 20, 30 minutes. We met with all members of the emergency room who were available, and reviewed the forms, and especially this form. This is the basic information that we had that we were looking for. It was pretty simple. The process would be that once the person was being discharged, the staff person, one of the staff persons in the emergency room, would talk to the patient about this follow-up project, and if they agreed to it, they would have them sign the consent form, gather this piece of information, and then the form would be faxed over to our office. Our goal would then be to contact the person within 24 hours of the time that they were being discharged. And during that follow-up call, we really had three tasks that we would do. Our first goal would be to reassess their suicidality, to kind of get an understanding of how much at risk they were, and then we would develop a safety plan or reinforce a plan that might have already been in place, go over some of the components of that, and then really work with the person to understand what their linkage plan was, what outgoing provider they had in place, and if they didn't have one, we were more than willing to help them with that linkage. And our goal was to, once we did that, we would then continue to follow up with them until the time that they made contact with that first outpatient provider appointment. Sometimes that was if they had a provider, sometimes that was within a few days. If it was a new provider to the person, that may take a few weeks, but we would stay in contact with them. And our contacts with the individuals were really based on how at risk they were or how concerning they were. Sometimes we would call daily, but other times just checking in once or twice a week was enough for the person. And we basically continued our follow-up calls until they made contact with that first provider or until the person said, you know, I'm okay, I no longer need the follow-up calls, and we understood that to be the case. The program was supposed to go for about a year. It took us about 3 months to coordinate the memorandum of understanding with the hospital. Both sides, both legal teams had to deal with understanding getting the language just right. So that took a little longer than I was expecting, but after the first 3 months, we started taking referrals. And we, over the course of the next 9 months, we received 46 referrals. It started out very well. During the first 3 months, we got about 25 referrals, so they were averaging about two a week. But then there was a period of time where the referrals started to die down, and during the next 6 months, we received only 21 referrals, which was less than one a week. So we had some meetings with some staff at the hospital, although they weren't working in the emergency room. One of the reasons why I picked Lutheran Hospital was because I had a connection with one of the people in charge of the social service department, but they didn't have social workers in the emergency room. So while this person was able to open the doors to the hospital staff that allowed us to get in, she didn't have any direct oversight over the emergency room. So I did the initial training at the hospital, but I never got back together with the emergency room staff to remind them of the project and give them the feedback that I wanted to provide them. Some of the good things about the program was we successfully made contact with all 46 people that we were referred. Not each of them, we didn't get to each one of them within 24 hours. I believe we made an attempt within 24 hours for each of them. Sometimes it took a few attempts to reach the person, but we did reach all 46 of them. We know that none of the 46 of those individuals during the time of the project died by suicide. None of them made a suicide attempt that we're aware of. And one of the more important things is that none of these 46 returned to Lutheran's emergency room for a mental health issue during the time of our follow-up. They may have gone to one of the other 16 hospitals in the county, but they didn't return to Lutheran, which was a very good thing that Lutheran appreciated, us being able to keep people out of the emergency room and us working with the person as an outpatient. I do know about the suicides because I work very closely with the medical examiner in Cuyahoga County, and they send me weekly information about the people who they suspect or have ruled as a suicide. So I'm able to keep up on that information on a pretty regular basis. As far as agency resources used, this was not a very laborious project on our end. We made a total of 238 follow-up calls to these individuals. It averaged about 5 calls per person. About 80% of the calls were made by one person working part-time. She worked 4 hours a day, Monday through Friday, and her primary role was to come in and make these follow-up calls during her time. We did have somebody else making calls on the weekends, but most of the calls were made by this one part-time person. Our crisis team did go out to go see 3 of the 46 people who we felt were their risk was elevated at some point during our follow-up process, and we were able to go out, see them, do an assessment, and actually bring all 3 of them in to see our psychiatrist within 72 hours of our assessment, and thereby, I think, keeping them from returning to the emergency room. And then we, again, continued to facilitate their work with linkage to an ongoing provider. I think when I talk about the successes of this project, I think that we were very pleased to be able to reach every person that was referred to us. We didn't really expect that. Certainly some people that go to the emergency rooms can be somewhat transient. They might not have numbers. I think that there was a possibility that every person that was referred to us had a phone number, and I think perhaps the emergency room staff didn't make referrals to our program if they didn't have a phone or a way to reach them. They could have. I didn't really go into that. They could maybe have done that with our crisis team. We could have possibly gone out, but we didn't get any referrals like that, so we were able to, over a period of time, reach everyone that was referred to us. We were also very excited about how positive the clients were. John alluded to a previous study where how grateful people were to receive these follow-up calls, that just to know that somebody cared about them enough to reach out seemed to really be a huge positive to the people we were contacting. And the thought that this wasn't a one-time contact, that we were going to stay with you and call you every couple days and make sure you're okay, that seemed to really be a very, very helpful thing to the people we were reaching out to. And our ability to link people to an ongoing provider was critical. We know that that's a big part of the problem, is that when someone leaves an emergency room, they don't connect to an ongoing provider, and our ability to help people. And a couple of times we would call and advocate at an agency for somebody. We just made sure that these connections were made. That was, besides keeping the person out of the emergency room or trying to hurt themselves, getting them linked to a provider was really our primary goal. The challenges we faced, the creation of the Memorandum of Understanding took a long time. As we talked a little bit more to other crisis centers and their work doing something similar to this, they also experienced the same thing. And I think any crisis center going into this or hospital going into this process probably needs to prepare for that and know that that takes a while to get started, to get through and get approved. And this is when it's a new protocol, it's something that probably needs to be reinforced a couple of times to remind the staff that this is a program that is available, and even to provide some feedback. I attempted to give some feedback back to the hospital about how successful we were being with the individuals we were contacting, knowing that once it's seen that it's working, that would maybe reinforce continual referrals to come in. So we really wanted to be able to have a better communication back and forth with the ED staff. I think we probably would have gotten more referrals, or at least kept up with the 2 a week that we were getting initially. This is the contact information for anyone that may have further questions later on. They feel free to contact me about it. I really thought it was a great project. It opened up some doors for us as far as possibilities to reach out to people at risk. I think it was not that difficult for us to do, and I think the payoff was very beneficial. So I'm a strong advocate for this type of project, and think it's a win-win for both the crisis centers and the hospitals. So if there's anyone who has any questions, I'd be happy to answer any.
Thanks, Rick. There are some questions. What made you decide to use one staff person for the majority of the follow-up calls, and what hours did that person work?
They came in about 3 o'clock, and they worked until 7 o'clock. That was their 4-hour shift. I enjoyed working with one person because I was able to work with her on focusing what we're trying to do, how we're doing it. It was probably just easier for me to do it that way. All of our staff are capable. We have paid staff, and many of them are licensed social workers or counselors, and any of them could do this work. But working with one, she was the one that collected the data. It just was a more manageable project for me to use one person. But certainly this could have been spread across. And it also was good continuity for the people we were calling to hear the same person. Mm. That seemed to be a small benefit, but it really could be done spread out over a number of people.
Another question, after the initial phone call within the first 24 hours, what was the frequency of phone calls until the connection was made with a mental health provider?
The frequency was really determined by how at risk we felt the person was, and that was decided at each phone call. We would take a sense of how the person was doing and get an understanding with them on when the next call would be. So sometimes it would be the next day if the person was a little unstable, or if they were doing pretty well, we would say, well, we'll call you in 2 or 3 days and we'll check on them. And one of the better parts of this project also was putting our phone number in the hands of people that might not have known about our service. So there were a handful of times when they called us, as opposed to waiting for our follow-up call. They would call us if something was going on, which was just a good way to promote our service. In addition to reaching out to them, they were able to reach back to us.
Could you maybe also, hold on one sec, I have another question that I typed over here. I wonder about if there are any differences you could identify in trying to implement this particular model. Is there any kind of difference between a local volunteer staff crisis line and a crisis line staffed by therapists?
I think that it can be done. I think it's probably beneficial in any way you can put it together. We are local in the county. We know the hospitals. We know the services here. You know, the more local you are, the more resources you know. But other than that, if I had volunteers that were working on this, they could do it. And I also can envision this happening with using a crisis center that's not necessarily very close to the emergency room, as long as they have good access to resources. The primary thing is following up with the individual, making sure they're safe, and knowing what to do when they're not. And you can do that whether you have a crisis team and you're in the community, or whether you're a fair ways away and just need to reach out to someone who can help the person more locally to where they are. I think it can help work either way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Rick. There are some questions that I want to open up to the all three presenters. One of our participants, though, has asked if they could get access to your consent memo of understanding in various forms that you used.
I'd be happy to send that to anyone. If they send me an email, I'd be happy to send it to anyone who requests that.
And what is your email address?
It's RICK. There it is. On
there
the
it is right there.
Yes.
So for anyone who would like Rick to share various documents that are supporting this program, there's his email address there. Send him an email, and he'd be happy to send them to you.
And you can also send a request to us. Since there are a few other centers that are doing what Rick's doing, feel free to give us a shout as well. You can just contact Marshall Ellis at that email address that was provided on the earlier slide.
Great. Rick, a couple of questions that just came in a moment ago, so I'm not done with you yet.
Okay.
How do you pay for hotline services once grant funding runs out?
Our program is funded by the Alcohol, Drug Abuse, and Mental Health Services Board of our county. They provide funding for us to do the mobile crisis piece and the hotline piece as well. So we are using some of their funding to continue the project as we go forward.
Okay. And then what could you identify or have you identified as some of the limitations or challenges for other centers that might want to implement a similar model? And at this, once you have a chance to respond to that, I might open that up to John as well.
When I continue this forward, I'm focusing right now the next couple of hospitals. I'd like to bring this out to all 17 hospitals in our county at some point, but I'm taking the project to a couple of hospitals that actually have social work staff in their emergency rooms, because I think they may have the time. Lutheran only had doctors and nurses and techs, and they were busy doing a lot of other things for the people in the emergency room. I think the social work staff might be able to identify and have time to do the paperwork and make the referrals to us. I think I'm thinking that might be a good way to go forward. Not that all emergency rooms have that, but we might see a greater increase in referrals with coming from the social work staff.
I guess I'd like to mention more of a helicopter view of the problem. I see our healthcare system is broken, and that all of the interventions, or many of the interventions, simply have no place in a reimbursement-driven system, that none of the services are reimbursed. They all are provided by grants from SAMHSA, from local areas, from individual departments. And until we solve that problem, these sorts of interventions are going to be hard to implement on any large basis.
Good point. And then, John, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, a few things. I would very much agree with that, David. Thank you for pointing that out, because it while it's an incredibly cost-effective service and you can help a lot of people for a little amount of money and save lives, you know, it isn't free. I mean, it is important that there be some funding, and, you know, it can even be funding one person who could make a difference in hundreds of lives. You know, over a period of time by following up. So it really is a very worthwhile investment. That is a challenge, though, and I think a couple of other challenges were embedded in Rick's presentation, one of which is, as you noted, Rick, that a lot of folks just forgot to refer this person to the aftercare discharge follow-up. And I think this is more of an attitudinal thing. I think, and quite naturally, a lot of folks who work in emergency departments are just accustomed to focusing on the entrance door as opposed to the exit door. So if you have somebody who is really dedicated, such as a social worker, or even somebody from the crisis center that perhaps could be hired to stay there in the emergency department to help people with the discharge planning and the aftercare follow-up, that would really be very helpful, I think, to a number of the emergency departments. I think the other issue that you also noted in there, Rick, was about legal issues. And there is Glenn Currier from Rochester, who does a lot of research in this area, says this is, you know, in many ways the biggest barrier for a lot of emergency departments, hospitals, and anybody who's faced with chain of care issues is they keep thinking about HIPAA and what is it, how that might prevent them from being able to communicate across systems to be able to maintain someone's care. And a lot of it is simply myth. Certainly some of it is reality, but the realities can be, as you have seen, Rick, can be managed. That there's clearly secure ways to transmit information, but A, it's through consent that somebody will sign off on, and secondly, and B, we're talking about people's safety, which HIPAA will make exceptions for. So it is important that we not let the word HIPAA get in the way of intelligent and thoughtful conversations about how to make this work.
Here's one. Have you worked with the VA ER, and is this setup applicable to the VA? It works a little differently than other ERs.
Yeah, I don't. That's a great question. I really don't know. I do know that they have suicide prevention follow-up. They have coordinators, suicide prevention coordinators. My assumption is that at every area, I mean, I know that it works with the crisis hotline for the VA, but anybody who is at risk in the VA system can and should be referred to the suicide prevention coordinator, who would then follow up with their care and hold their hand as they walk them through the system. So I would assume that the suicide prevention coordinator's job would be to do just that in this situation as well.
The VA's mandate is, once the suicide prevention coordinator is contacted, the suicide prevention coordinator makes sure that there is an appointment within 24 to 48 hours of the first phone call. And thereafter, there's a mandate that continuity of care be ensured, because there needs to be a report that the patient actually showed up and is in treatment. VA's also mandated what I suggested.
David, do you mind speaking up a little bit? It's really hard to hear you.
Hopefully, is it better now?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, I'm sorry. Let me retrace. Once the suicide prevention coordinator is identified and contacted, the suicide prevention coordinator is responsible for giving the patient the contact, an appointment, within 24 to 48 hours. And thereafter, there is to be a check system to make sure that the patient showed up for the appointment and continues in care. Now, they've gone so far as in the VA to mandate the 7-day rule that I spoke about. That is, once a discharge takes place from an inpatient unit, the follow-up appointment has to be within 7 days. Not only that, but there has to be a opportunity for a weekly appointment for the first month after discharge from an inpatient unit.
Great. One last question, if it could be, we'll go out on a more general note here. Data from non-USA countries show the same effect, that risk goes up post-discharge. Do we know why risk goes up?
The data is that once you're in a hospital, there really are very few interventions used by a hospital, or for that matter, an emergency department, that are actually designed to prevent suicide. So we're discharging people, as I sometimes say, that we are so sick that we formerly used to admit them. So we're discharging people who are still at high risk, and the inpatient length of stay and certainly the anti-suicide therapeutics that are available in the emergency department, I think, are relatively ineffective tools given the risk that the patient has when they come in the door.
Thank you, David. And thank you. Unfortunately, we're out of time, so I want to thank all of our presenters once again for sharing their insights and expertise. Thanks also to those of you who participated in the webinar. You will be receiving an email in the next day or so requesting that you fill out a brief evaluation of this session. We hope you'll take a few moments to let us know how useful the webinar was for you. Again, the session will be posted, the slides and audio, in the next few days on the SPRC website. And if you have any questions, you can contact Tiffany Kim at the email address on your screen? This concludes our webinar. Thank you, everyone, and have a great rest of your week.